locks for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer who worked in Afghanistan. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, and she's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And what was your impressions of the president's address recently at Bagram Air Force Base following a kind of stealth entry into Afghanistan and, of course, under criticism from the Republican nominee Mitt Romney for making too much of the anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden?
I mean, mostly the comments I thought were kind of bizarre were those about Pakistan and the nature of our relationship and what it is that we're trying to achieve and how. The comments that were made there really didn't seem to map onto reality at all. They seem to be about as fantastic as some of the statements that have been made by Pakistan's Foreign Minister Carr.
But is there anything new in that? In other words, the United States and Pakistan have been talking past each other, pretending they have a workable relationship, and arguably they've never been on the same page.
No, I mean, there's nothing new in it, but I certainly did expect from the president to have a much more straightforward discussion about the complexities in that relationship and how we're going to get things done with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship being so shambolic. I would have liked to have had a more straightforward discussion about drones, for example. I mean, how can we continue to run the drone program against such stark Pakistani domestic opposition? You know, essentially the Pakistan civilians are trying to turn back the decisions that President Musharraf made. Basically, they're saying he sold our sovereignty, but he didn't have a right to do so. And without Pakistani cooperation, you know, the accuracy of those drones go way down. Arguably, as the U.S. transitions from a heavy counterinsurgency footing to a counterterrorism footing, you know, things like the drone program are going to be an important tool. And so having better relations with Pakistan in some very minimal way is going to be key to making this reoptimized policy work. So, I mean, there's nothing surprising in that he said, but I mean, at some point, I really would like the administration to be a little bit less diplomatic and to sort of take the Americans into confidence about the real challenges that we confront as we try to get out of Afghanistan.
But, Chris Fair, you work in Washington and talk to all the experts in that theater, and I would assume that there's the public reality and the private reality, that it never looks like it's worked. We spent a lot of treasure and lives on a place. There's nothing to show for it. We don't have a partner in the local government of this corrupt Karzai. Are there two narratives, the public and the private? Because it seems like the American people want the hell out of there, and it looks like Obama is actually pretty determined to get out by 2014, or at least to start getting out by 2014.
Well, I actually don't think there is this stark difference between what people say publicly and what they say privately. What I found disappointing in the talk that he gave was that, you know, essentially, if anyone who reads the New York Times, Washington Post, any McClatchy newspaper with the incredibly insightful articles written by my colleague, Jonathan Landay, anyone who essentially reads knows that the relationship is not what was being described. And so I guess I don't really understand the need for the use of an incredibly deceptive language when what we really need is someone to speak very straightforwardly about what our interests are and how we're going to secure them and over what time horizon. And so given that I do live in Washington, I do talk to different folks, I don't read, I don't see the difference between this public and private discussion.
Well, but I would have thought that in private people might say, you know, what have we gained? What has it been worth? You know,
but they're saying this publicly. I mean, I don't think there are too many people who can say with a straight face, without being ridiculed, that we have made enormous gains in Afghanistan.
But the president said that the other night.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. What the president said the other night was really striking, because it was so discordant with what the vast majority of people believe. It just wasn't a credible message. I mean, what we really want to know is, you know, what are our core interests? How do we secure those interests going forward? And of course, this does come into play with the documents that were released from the CTC from the Bin Laden compound. And Bin Laden, for example, suggests in one of the missives that they need to find a new place other than Afghanistan and Pakistan from which to stage external attacks. Right. So, I mean, I'm not someone who wants to be on the perpetual Al-Qaeda gravy train. By no means do I want to fall into that position of the sky is constantly falling. But we also can't be completely naive to the fact that there are elements of that organization and even other terror groups outside of that organization that do still aspire to attack Americans. And so having some minimal presence in the region is going to be important for the policy-relevant future. And, you know, Osama bin Laden may be dead, but this doesn't mean that there aren't other organizations that are capable and interested in attacking the United States. And I really didn't find President Obama's speech to really speak to, A, what we actually know about the region and the genuine questions that we have about how do we move forward and out of the region.
Well, it seems that Christine Fair, again, a former United Nations political officer who worked in Afghanistan and a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. It would seem that the U.S.-Pakistani relationship is akin to a married couple who aren't speaking to each other, and neither has filed for a divorce. But the importance of Pakistan, of course, is significant in terms of providing the means of all the material that's shipped in there. And since that incident in which 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed, it seems that there have been very little communication. Recent talks broke down. My understanding is that there's an awful lot of supplies that aren't getting through, but the bigger question might well be that what happens in 2014 when the U.S. pulls out? Will they be leaving a bunch of stuff behind like the Russians did, or will the Pakistanis not necessarily want to cooperate on the exit?
Yeah, so I'm glad you raised that point, because the positive side of what happened in the aftermath of the Sohala strike and American intransigence to offer an apology, which for the record, I think is way overdue. We should have apologized then, and the apology that it hasn't been forthcoming is due to election issues. Everyone's worried about the endless loop of a potential Mitt Romney advertisement whereby various reports of Pakistani perfidy, and then it ends with an Obama apology, right? So there's the rationale behind the not apologizing has a lot to do with domestic politics, as well as the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. But after the GLOC closure, the Americans learned an important lesson, that we can actually sustain that war in Afghanistan without Pakistani GLOCs. And the way they're doing it is that they're flying stuff in. And then they've also increased some of the stuff that's coming in through the northern distribution route. So we are supplying that. We're continuing to supply the war. It's not the case that the closure of the GLOCs has really put a lot of operational pressure. But the real issue is, as you noted, how do we get all of that stuff out? And you also, I think, correctly noted that the options are fairly straightforward, and different actors have different incentives. So we could do what the Russians did and just leave the stuff in place. And, you know, anyone who's taken a road trip around Afghanistan will see, you know, various tanks just abandoned. Some of that stuff could theoretically be made available for use by the Afghans if they could maintain the stuff. Other stuff we could simply destroy and burn in place. But you can certainly imagine that the Pakistani black markets would certainly benefit from some of that stuff there. So it's not clear that the Pakistanis have a clear incentive to get the GLOCs opened again so we can get our stuff out. Although I think you could more credibly argue that stuff could be amenable to pilferage on its way through Pakistan than if it stays in Afghanistan. But that's the real reason why we want the G-locks open at this point, is to try to get the stuff out of Afghanistan.
Well, just in closing, Christine Fair, what's your sense then what happens after 2014? You get the feeling that the Pakistanis are keeping their powder dry. They've never wanted the U.S. to go after the Haqqani network. They seem to be stronger than ever. They'll surely have some influence on what happens. Nobody has any confidence in the Afghan army. What is your day after scenario?
Well, I think the day after scenario does kind of hinge upon what the day after actually looks like. So I don't think too many people expect that the U.S. is really cutting and running, or even, for that matter, severing and sauntering. We're going to have some presence there. We're going to continue our training mission. We'll have some presence there in extremis so that we could actually help the Afghans if the Afghan security forces themselves fail to muster. I also don't think that the Afghan Taliban are in a position to just run back into Kabul. That being said, you know, the Afghan constitution does not lend itself terribly well to any sort of peace and reconciliation amongst the different groups in Afghanistan who ultimately have to live together peaceably. You know, we did build, and it was the U.S. and the international community that gave Afghanistan this constitution. It's highly, highly centralized. And this is where Congressman Rohrabacher got into a lot of trouble. Congressman Rohrabacher argued for greater federalism. He took it a little bit further, of course, than simply making a constitutional argument. But while I don't agree with a lot of what Congressman Rohrabacher wrote, said, and did, I do think he makes a really important point about federalism. At the end of the day, the various commanders, war criminal, pederast, jung bazi that they are under the rubric of the Northern Alliance, and the various commanders associated with the Taliban, at the end of the day, there has to be reconciliation. And that is going to require some degree of political accommodation. And that's very difficult to imagine with Afghanistan's current constitution. So in this regard, you will find many people in Afghanistan, as well as among journalists that cover it, fearing that what we're really likely to see is some sort of return to an ultimate civil war in Afghanistan.
Well, meanwhile, though, again, the president said the other day at Bagram that, you know, we're going to complete the training of the Afghan army. Well, I heard a statistic the other day that one third of U.S. and NATO casualties come from the friendlies, the people we're training who shoot us in the back. Is that right?
I haven't seen that statistic, and so I'm not in a position to evaluate it. I don't even want to speculate about the accuracy of the number. But what we do know is that there has been a very large number of Afghans killing NATO ISAF troops. We see actual Taliban infiltrating the ANSF precisely for that purpose. We see people appearing in uniforms, killing people. I mean, this has happened with an alarming frequency over the last several years. And this has actually driven some countries. I think France wanted to escalate. I could be wrong. I think it's France. Wanted to escalate its timeline for getting the heck out because of these friendly fire episodes. I mean, ultimately, you know, we're in these positions of close proximity, allegedly, to be training these guys. And in addition to worrying about a Talib assault or some other kind of security incident, these soldiers who are there on a training mission have to also be worried that an Afghan is going to turn a gun on them. So, you know, this is difficult. But whatever it means to finish the training of the ANA, it's going to end in a farce in any event. I mean, the ANA, there's only so much you can do with a force that's absolutely, largely illiterate. The ANA overall is more illiterate than the Afghan society from which it draws. Usually militaries are better educated than the society from which they draw because they eliminate the least qualified people. You've got corruption. The ills of this organization reflect the ills of the rest of the government, right? So the idea that we're going to finish our training of the ANA, that's kind of an absurd thing to say, because how do you actually finish the training of an organization that has a requirement for endless training?
Oh, boy. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who is a former United Nations political officer who worked in Afghanistan. She's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, and she's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Jackson Brown.
Gonna pull